Good day. Today is Wednesday, 27th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again that to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, over the last 24 hours, we've had some responses in the West to the Russian advice, and I should stress at the moment it is advice, not a demand, the Russian advice that Western diplomats, for their own safety, quit Kiev and go somewhere to the West, because Kiev now is an open target for the Russian missile forces. Anyway, we've had some responses from the West in connection with this. The French government has made it clear that their embassy remains in Kiev and that their diplomats remain there as well. The Polish government has spoken in the same way. They have said that if there is any harm done, any injury done to Polish diplomats in Kiev, this will be entirely the fault of the Russians. And the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, after speaking to Sergei Lavrov, as I discussed in my program yesterday, has said that the war is indeed caught up in a pattern of escalation. One strike is then responded to by an even bigger strike. That is basically all we have seen up to now. Nobody should be surprised about this. It's because the war is going from one escalation to another that the United States has tried so hard since President Trump became president to achieve a resolution of the war, an end to the war. And notably, interestingly, he did not say whether the United States would indeed close its embassy in Kiev and withdraw its diplomats, nor did he say that the Russians acted inappropriately by conducting the massive strike using Oreshniks and Kinjals and Zircons and Iskanders and other such missiles against Kiev. So that was Marco Rubio's, in some ways, typically elliptical, one might almost say evasive, even though he does do it, it must be said, rather well. He's one of these people who can both appear to be, can be evasive without being exactly so. Anyway, this was Marco Rubio's evasive way of not saying what the United States would do in response both to the Russian attack on Kiev and the Russian warning of further attacks to come, and the Russian advice that the diplomats leave. For the moment, there is no sign that any Western diplomatic missions intend to leave Kiev. I am going here to make a guess, actually it's not a guess, to make a prediction that if we do start to see intensified strikes against Kiev of the sort that the Russians are now talking about, then the Western diplomats and the Western embassies will indeed leave. It is all very well for people like the Poles to say that if any Polish diplomats are killed or injured as a result of Russian missile and drone strikes on Kiev, then the blame for this will fall entirely upon the Russians. The reality is that no rational government leaves their diplomats, puts their diplomats in a position where their lives, and that, by the way, of their families, if they have their families with them in Kiev, might be placed in jeopardy. if missile and drone strikes on Kiev do now intensify and diplomats' lives are put at risk, the West will indeed pull them out. By the way, and for everybody's recollection, before the start of the special military operation, when there was a lot of talk that the Russians would sweep down on Kiev and seize the city, the United States and the various other Western powers and the governments of several other countries, including from recollection, India and China, did indeed pull their embassies out of Kiev and relocate them to the city of Lvov in the far west of Ukraine. And that happened before the war even began, and at a time when, as we have now good reason to know, the Russians did not actually plan to storm Kiev in exactly the way that some people in the West supposed. On the contrary, directly after the special military operation, the day after, in fact, as I remember, Vladimir Putin ordered a ceasefire, and 2 days later, negotiations between the Russians and the Ukrainians to find a way out of the conflict, the negotiations which led to the Istanbul Agreement of April 2022. Well, those negotiations on the second day of the conflict actually began. So throughout that time, throughout March and the first days of April, as I remember, the Western embassies remained in Lvov, even though there was actually very little fighting around Kiev, and none, as I remember, within Kiev itself. And they only returned to Kiev after the Russians pulled back from Kiev, as the Russians now say, because Emmanuel Macron tricked them into doing so. It was only after that happened that the Western embassies returned. Well, given that previous history, no one should suppose now that when it is the Russians who are saying something which they did not say in February or March of 2022, that Western diplomats might be at risk, no one should suppose that now that it is the Russians who are warning about it. No one should think that if the missiles and the drones do indeed start to pour in, these embassies will remain where they are. I can understand why at the moment, especially given the narrative in the West about how well Ukraine is currently doing, there is some unwillingness to show weakness and to act in a way that might contradict that narrative by pulling the embassies out of Kiev. But as I said, if the missiles and the drones start to fall, I have no doubt that that is exactly what will happen. And it might happen in rather humiliating circumstances with the Western governments, which means in effect the United States, calling the Russians, asking the Russians for a pause in any ongoing missile and drone offensive to enable the Western diplomats and their families and the other embassy staff to leave. So, as I said, brave words at the moment, but not words which, in my opinion, one should take especially seriously. Incidentally, and to finish off on this point, if they do leave, it will be a big shock for the Ukrainians. It will be deeply demoralizing for them. It will mean that the West no longer believes that Kiev itself is safe. That could, as happened in March 2022, trigger a major exodus of people from Kiev. It would isolate the Ukrainian authorities in Kiev itself, where they would no longer have Western diplomats and maybe NGOs and foreign Western personnel present on the ground to call upon. And my own view is that even if that were to happen, the government, the Ukrainian government, and the Ukrainian military and political leadership would nonetheless resolve to remain in Kiev. They would fear, I suspect, a total collapse in morale and resistance, not just in Kiev itself, but possibly even eastern Ukraine, were they in fact to quit Kiev. So I strongly suspect that they will choose to remain. But if the Western embassies leave, or perhaps when the Western embassies leave, it will be a major psychological blow for them. And lastly, I should add something else. I can imagine that the Russians might hold back from further missile and drone strikes during the period when the Western and other embassies, by the way, were exiting Kiev. I cannot imagine that the Russians would agree to such a thing simply to allow Zelensky to go on his travels. We might find a situation where Russian drone and missile strikes start to target the railway stations and the railway lines and as well, in which case Zelensky himself and his officials might find themselves marooned in Kiev. Anyway, we shouldn't move too far ahead of events because, of course, there is still the question of whether the Russians do indeed intend to act on what they have just said that they're going to do, which is these attacks on Kiev that they are not now talking about. Now, as to that, I will return briefly to what I said in my program yesterday, that what the Russian Foreign Ministry published, the statement the Foreign Ministry published, was not an ultimatum. It was a clear and, so far as I could see, conclusive statement of intention that these attacks on Kiev will now indeed take place. The decision to make them has been made. And secondly, we need to recall also that when Lavrov spoke to Rubio, the readout the Russians provided made clear that Lavrov was talking to Rubio, carrying the instructions of no less a person than Putin himself. And by the way, Rubio not only confirmed that in the comments he made after the call, which I've just discussed, but he went further. He said that Lavrov impressed on Rubio the importance of conveying the warning that Lavrov was giving to President Trump himself, making it clear that the warning does indeed come from Putin. Now, a couple of days ago, I speculated that when Putin returned to Moscow from China, he would quite plausibly call Trump himself and would give a warning, a strong warning, about Ukrainian drone attacks directly to Trump, much as he did on the 29th of April. I was a little surprised when the call came from Lavrov instead, and this was so, notwithstanding the fact that the Russian readout of the call made it clear that it was taking place on Putin's direct instructions. I did wonder why Putin chose not to call Trump himself. Well, over the last 24 hours, we have the reason, and it's simply a scheduling reason. Putin, almost as soon as he arrived in Moscow, flew to Kazakhstan, Russia's ally, main ally in Central Asia, where he's having discussions with President Tokayev. I could completely understand why Putin would not want to give a warning of this kind to Trump from the territory of Kazakhstan. The Kazakhs might not be happy for a warning of this kind to be given by the Russians to the Americans from their territory. And it was this reason, I am sure, which explains why the call came from Lavrov as opposed to Putin himself. Anyway, I don't think it makes much difference. And for the record, Rubio said that he has indeed passed on Lavrov's, ultimately Putin's, warning to Trump. Now, that's what we know from these two statements, the Russian Foreign Ministry statement and the Russian readout of the Lavrov-Rubio call, that we know from the Russians, that we have from the Russians, that this is a declaration of intention, that a decision has been made to conduct further strikes on Kiev. And as I said, this is no longer a question of if, it is a question of something that has now been decided. And the Russians, a couple of days ago, did something else, which I see as consistent with this, and which I think has been to some extent misunderstood. Now, about 3 days ago, 3 or 4 days ago, the Russians announced that they were closing their airspace to private, to unscheduled flights by private aircraft. Now, to be clear, these are not scheduled flights. These are not this kind of flights that Russian airlines undertake, or which agricultural users undertake, you know, to spray crops and that kind of thing, which are also in Russia, as I understand it, scheduled with the aviation authorities as well. It is private flights. Russia, some years ago, entered into the world of business jets. They do exist in significant quantity in Russia. The Russians also have, you know, significant clubs where people fly. It's actually quite a big sport in Russia. There's also there's also cases, there's gliding clubs too. Also, by the way, a significant sport in Russia as well. And of course, there's many people who do all kinds of things with drones. Now, partly, and this is what most people suppose, this could be in order to clear the skies, to make it easier for the Russians to track Ukrainian drones as they seek to penetrate Russian airspace. There almost certainly is an element of this too. But coming shortly before this statement by the Russians, the statement about a coming missile offensive, missile and drone offensive, specifically targeting Kiev, I suspect that it's mostly intended to clear the skies over central and western Russia to facilitate the organization and movement of Russian missile and drones over the Russian skies as they are prepared and organized for the strikes against Kiev. If, for example, missiles are now increasingly being launched from ground launchers, and this is apparently true of the Tsarkon hypersonic missiles and also of the KH-101s, then presumably some of these missile launchers will be located in precisely this territory where the airspace is being closed to private flights. And, well, we have seen the way in which the Russians have increasingly organized their Geran drones. There are many different families of Geran drones, how drones communicate continuously now with each other, how they form perhaps not so much swarms as large clouds. And again, presumably, they are organized into these clouds over Russian airspace, precisely this airspace, prior to their heading towards Kiev. Again, it seems to me consistent with what we know, that this is why this decision has been taken, to close this airspace to private flights in order to facilitate Russian air operations against Kiev itself. So this is a concrete sign of what it seems to me that the Russians are now preparing to do. And again, I think this is something that has not been widely reported or understood in the West. But anyway, it's my view. Now, beyond that, we've also had a number of commentaries by various Russian commentators, and all of them also, without exception, believe that the attacks on Kiev, the mass attacks on Kiev, are now indeed going to happen. One of the commentators who spoke in this way, and I'm taking this from a roundtable discussion with Russian experts that was organized by the Russian newspaper Kommersant. Anyway, one of these people was Andrei Ilnitsky, who is a military officer and who is a member of the Presidium of the Council on Foreign and Defense Policy in Russia, which is, to my knowledge, an extremely senior think tank indeed. However, in some respects, even more interesting were the words about this pending offensive made by Sergei Poletayev, the Russian commentator I have spoken about on several cases in the past, and Dmitry Suslov, who is a Russian academic at the High School of Economics, focusing on international relations, and again, somebody to take extremely seriously in Russia, somebody who I know personally knows Putin himself, and who has had various discussions at various times with Putin. Anyway, both of these two people, Poletayev and Suslov, say something very interesting, and it comes back to some of the points that I was making in the programme yesterday. The attack on Starobelsk might indeed have been the trigger for this decision. The last straw, the moment when the Russians resolved that this was what they would do, and when they also resolved that the time to do it was now. But both Poletayev and Suslov think that there is a further reason for the Russian decision, and that is the severe depletion of air defences around Kiev itself. Poletayev's point is that over the last 2 years, especially perhaps since the United States began to the mass supply of Patriot missile interceptors to Ukraine, over the last 2 years, 2 or 3 years, Kiev outside Russia has become the city with the strongest air defences in Europe. Those air defences have now become severely depleted. Ukraine is not receiving deliveries of Patriot missile interceptors. Patriots are now universally acknowledged to be in critically short supply. This was already true last year when the Pentagon, for a time, sought to stop Patriot missile deliveries to Ukraine. That decision was reversed by no less a person than Donald Trump himself. But then, since that decision was first made and reversed in the late spring of last year, we've had the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and the United States and Iran. Numbers of missile interceptors have become sharply reduced since then. The priority now has to be to rebuild American stockpiles. There simply are no Patriot missile interceptors available to provide to Ukraine anymore. And Ukraine obviously still has a few. They used some of them ineffectively against the Russian strike 4 days ago. But everybody acknowledges that the number of Patriot missile interceptors still retained, possessed by Ukraine, has now dwindled to a very small number, which means, to all intents and purposes, that the sky over Kiev is open. Now, I want to say here that the sky over Kiev has, in my opinion, always been open to attacks by ballistic missiles, Iskanders, and has always been open to attacks by hypersonic missiles, Tsarkons, kinjals and oreshniks. And as we've seen in the Middle East, in the fighting in the Middle East, Patriot missiles are not the best weapons to use against drones, Geran drones or Shahed drones, and I suspect that much of the time, most of them have got through when they have been launched at Kiev. But the Patriot missiles can shoot down KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles, which are obviously cheaper than the Kinjals, the Tsarkons, and the Oreshniks. And by the way, I suspect the Iskanders as well. And since I suspect that the Russians now have ground launchers for KH-101s as well, it makes logical sense for the Russians to focus on using these subsonic cruise missiles as much as possible. Anyway, the Russians now believe that the skies again over Kiev are open and will remain open in the future. So this is a good moment to start the missile and drone offensive on Kiev. And as I also discussed in my program yesterday, I believe that technological and industrial developments, the completion of development of the Oreshnik and the Tsarkon, the entering of these missiles, as well as the Iskander and the Kinjal into mass production, the build-up of stockpiles of these systems, the development of the technologies to guide and control not just these missiles, but also the Geran drones over hostile airspace, and to coordinate mass strikes using all of these weapons, that all of this taken together has now happened, which now makes it possible for the Russian offensive against Kiev to begin. So when will the next strike happen? Well, I suspect that the Russians will wait a few days, maybe a week, maybe two, to see whether the West is going to pull its embassies out of Kiev. When it's clear that they're not doing so, then I suspect the offensive will indeed begin. And then I suspect the Western governments will face the reality and will contact the Russians and will ask them to put a pause so that the embassies can indeed at that point be withdrawn from Kiev. And not just the embassies, by the way, but the NGOs and the think tanks and the Western workers who work in them. And quite plausibly also some of the military liaison people who are currently in Kiev as well. So anyway, that's, I think, the shape of things to come. Now, even as all of this is going on, and we await the next big Russian attack, and by the way, at this point, I should say that Geran attacks continue against Ukraine all the time. There was another one last night. Every night now, Geran drones are active over the skies of Kiev. And this has been true for, well over a year now. And of course, the Ukrainians also tried to conduct their own attacks too. They launched an attack on an airfield in Voronezh in southern Russia. Doesn't, again, seem as if it did a great deal of damage. And they launched another attack on the Tuapse refinery in the Black Sea. The Russians say that a fire was started because of falling debris, which suggests that a drone was shot down, but that the fire was quickly put out. The interesting thing about the Russian statement and this renewed Ukrainian drone attack on Tuapse is that it strongly suggests that despite the previous Ukrainian drone attacks, Tuapse has been repaired and is still operational. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say on that issue. Anyway, despite all of the attention we've been giving to the missile and drone wars and the Russian threats against the decision-making centres in Kiev, well, the other part of the war continues, and we've had more information from the front lines. Firstly, in Zaporozhye region, in eastern Zaporozhye region, the Russians have now confirmed and provided very extensive video footage of the fall of the small town of Vozvizhevka to the north of Verkhnaya Terasa, which also fell, or which the Russians said had also fallen some days ago. Here, perhaps I should say that certain Russian sources, notably Rydovka, have been saying that Verkhnaya Terasa and Vozvizhevka were actually captured by the Russians roughly a week before today's announcement. But anyway, let's not get bogged down into discussions about why the Russians might have held this information back. There is no doubt that the Russians control Vozvizhevka. The video footage they provided, showing lots of Russian soldiers in the village, or small town rather, raising flags all over it, puts the question beyond doubt. So both Verkhnaya Terasa and Vozvizhevka have now fallen. The Russians are said to be very close to capturing the last village to the south of Verkhnaya Terasa on this fortified line of villages that have barred the route, the advance to Orekhov. This village is Gulyapolske. It looks as if that entire defence line, which is the last defence line ahead of Orekhov itself, is now collapsing. And of course, this has happened even as the Russians have advanced in the north of this area into Dnipropetrovsk region and have captured the village of Dobropasova, which I talked about some days ago, and are now threatening the small town of Pakrovska, which some reports are now claiming might also soon fall, and the two important towns of Velikomikhailovka and Novomikhailovka, which lie respectively to the east and west of Pakrovska. This entire defence line in the east, which is a defence line not just ultimately for Orekhov, but for the city of Zaporozhye, is falling, is crumbling. And, well, I've discussed in many places that Russian offensives in any one year start gradually and then gain momentum. We can see that momentum in Zaporozhye region is now building. If you look at a map of eastern Zaporozhye region, you can now see basically a straight line of territory under Russian control, with the Russians in a position not just to attack Orekhov from the east head on, but to outflank it also in the north. It's like a wave around Orekhov is building. And, well, it isn't just Orekhov ultimately that is being threatened here. It is the city of Zaporozhye itself. The Ukrainians spent the early part of spring doing whatever they could to prevent this from happening. That was the point of the Ukrainian counterattack in northeastern Zaporozhye region. The fall of Dobropassova shows that the Russians batted this Ukrainian counterattack away, and now this wave is about to crash on Orekhov and surge westwards towards Zaporozhye city itself and the Dnieper once Orekhov itself falls. Now, here I ought to say something further, which is that it's clear to me that the major threat to Zaporozhye city and to Ukrainian positions along the Dnieper comes from this advancing force that's closing in on Orekhov and ultimately on the city of Zaporozhye from the east. To the south of the city of Zaporozhye, there is General Teplinsky's group of forces, Dnieper, where apparently a large proportion of the Russian airborne forces are concentrated. There's been speculation that these forces might at some point attempt an advance towards the city of Zaporozhye, which is only, if you include its outlying suburbs, around 10 kilometers away from this force. I've come to the conclusion that the real purpose of General Teplinsky's forces are to prevent any Ukrainian counterattacks across the Dnieper from Kherson region, or indeed from the city of Zaporozhye itself. In other words, to protect eastern Kherson region and the approaches to Crimea. It is the armies that are advancing from the east that have advanced, in fact, steadily all the way from the city of Donetsk, taking in places like Marinka, Novomikhailovka, Selidovo, Kurakhovo, Velikaya Novosilka, Gulyapolye, the city of Gulyapolye. It is this force which is the force which will ultimately threaten and capture first Orekhov and ultimately the city of Zaporozhye itself. Anyway, I spent a little time talking about all of this. I think I've explained the position as I see it. Further to the north, we continue to get more reports about the situation in Konstantinovka. It looks as if there's at least two areas within Konstantinovka itself where the Ukrainians are trapped. The Russian war reporter Marat Khairulin has provided what, in my opinion, is the best and most authoritative account of the battle of Konstantinovka up to now. For the record, I consider Khairulin to be the best war reporter of all covering this war. He has a Substack site which you can follow, and where he provides detailed, very detailed updates about the situation on the front lines. And he's obviously, what he says is written in Russian, but it is expertly translated by someone who refers to himself as Zinder Nerf, and who I used to remember working previously at the Telegram channel called Slavyangrad. But anyway, it looks not just as if the situation in Konstantinovka for the Ukrainians is deteriorating, but my own guess is that we are now looking at a situation where the Russians now have either full control or a presence in something like 60% of the town. Probably what is slowing completion of this operation is precisely the existence of these two cauldrons, these two Ukrainian cauldrons in the south of Konstantinovka. Just saying. But it's clearly a battle that is coming towards its end now. And, well, there was a very interesting article. I say I find it interesting, very revealing article in some ways about the whole situation on the front lines, which you can find today in the British news agency Reuters. And it's a very interesting article because the title actually is very misleading, at least in all sorts of ways. Indeed, the article needs to be read with extreme care because if you take it casually, it's misleading altogether. But it says that a Ukrainian commander believes that the situation is now at a tipping point and that from this point on, the situation in the ground war might start to tip to the advantage of Ukraine. That's the impression you might receive if you read this article, shall we say, lightly. Now, when you read it carefully, it turns out otherwise. Firstly, the commander in question is Andrei Belitsky, who is indeed a very prominent Ukrainian commander. Reuters refers to him as the commander of the Ukrainian military's Third Corps, which, of course, he is. But I noticed that nowhere in the article does it mention another very important fact about him, which is that he is the founder and leader of the Azov force, a, shall we politely call it, far-right political movement, of which the Third Corps and the associate 12th Corps are, if you like, the armed part. So again, referring to Belitsky as simply a military commander significantly downplays, or rather doesn't downplay, it suppresses other interesting facts about him. He's a lot more than just a military official. He is a major political figure in Ukraine and has been so ever since the events of 2014. And he is a political figure whose power in Ukraine has been growing, and who some believe might be positioning himself eventually for a bid for political power in Ukraine itself. Anyway, that's one rather interesting fact about this Reuters article. The second is that the article very briefly mentions the situation in Konstantinovka. It says that the Russians are making incremental gains in Konstantinovka, and that the fall of Konstantinovka would jeopardize Ukrainian control of Donbass. Now, that is, of course, true in a kind of way. This has been a careful siege that the Russians have conducted in Konstantinovka. Khailulin, whom I spoke about a short while ago, has discussed in his latest piece about Konstantinovka the enormous development in sophistication in Russian urban warfare tactics over the course of the war. He speaks about how earlier on in the first urban battles that took place in the war, in Mariupol, in Bakhmut, in places like that, the Russians basically fought as if they were applying a sledgehammer. Today, it's a far more carefully thought through operation in Konstantinovka, as it was previously in Pokrovsk, one which involves, though obviously, far fewer casualties and does less damage. But anyway, you could call that an incremental way of capturing a place. But the point is that, in fact, if you follow the events in Konstantinovka closely, Konstantinovka is indeed falling. So, given that Reuters tells us that the fall of Konstantinovka might open the way for the Russians to capture the rest of Donbass, and since this is a war that ultimately began with a Russian decision first to recognize and then come to the protection of Donbass, and since all sorts of commentators, such as the Institute for the Study of War, tell us how important Donbass is for Ukraine's prospects in the war as a whole, news that the Russians are about to capture Konstantinovka, opening up the way to the fall of Donbass, to my mind, somewhat goes against the entire narrative, the rest of the narrative that this article is trying to provide us with, which is that the balance of the war is now shifting in the Ukrainians' favor. And then if we go to what Beletsky himself says, and well, I obviously profoundly abhor Beletsky's political views, to put it mildly, but I would never dispute that he is a clever man. Anyway, Beletsky actually says something quite different. He says that Ukraine has a 6-month window to turn things round. He doesn't say what might happen if that window is not used effectively, but clearly he leaves that open. And well, when you read what he says carefully, it turns out that he's not quite as optimistic as Reuters would want him to be. He claims, for example, that the Starlink system is providing the Ukrainians with major advantages in the field of communications. But he also says that in every other respect, the Russians and the Ukrainians possess parity. He must know that the reality is otherwise, that overall the Russians possess enormous technological leadership. The Ukrainians do not have fifth generation fighter jets or hypersonic missiles, for example. And he must also know that the development of new Russian satellite arrays almost certainly means that whatever communications advantage the Ukrainians up to now have had with the satellite, with the Starlink system, is most likely about to end. Anyway, there it is. That is the situation in the war. We're going to see major Russian strikes on Kiev, perhaps in a week or 2 weeks' time, and they're going to continue, and we're told that they're going to continue systematically, presumably for the rest of the war, putting in jeopardy perhaps Ukraine's drone offensive against Russia at the very least, but perhaps more practically also causing major problems for the Ukrainian government that risks being marooned in a Kiev which the West has abandoned. But anyway, that, it seems to me, is the situation in the war. Now, before I round off in my discussion of the war, I do again want to say quickly one very brief thing, which is that the speculation of a Russian move in the north from the territory of Belarus continues to remain intense. The Russians have captured more territory in Sumy region, by the way, over the last 24 hours since I made my last program. I'm not going to discuss this now. But anyway, there continues to be much chatter and speculation about a potential attack from Kiev. And there's also been commentaries about how, were the Russians to conduct drone attacks from Belarus into Ukrainian territory, that would conceivably sever remaining Ukrainian transport links from the West. The railway lines and the roads from Poland would certainly be within the relatively easy range of Russian drones were they to be launched from Belarus. To repeat again, I think that this is possible as a future plan. If we see a major Russian missile and drone offensive against Kiev, and assuming this continues through the summer and autumn and through the winter, that could indeed start to weaken and wear down Kiev's defences. And we might eventually see a swoop on Kiev, especially if the Russian positions in northeastern Ukraine are strengthened and Donbass falls. Ukraine could find itself in a catastrophic situation next spring if all of these events begin to play out. But I don't think that this plan is yet ready to be activated in that sort of way. And I think that if we're talking about Russian drone attacks from Kiev, towards Kiev rather, from Belarus and along the western supply roads from Belarus, then of course that exposes Belarus itself to counter attacks by Ukrainian drones. And again, I don't think either the Russians or the Belarusians are ready for that at the present time. I think politically this would be very costly for Belarus. But anyway, it's for the future, a future which, by the way, is very likely to come. A Ukrainian MP from the Rada, who is from Zelensky's own party, sent to Zelensky and the Ukrainian government a question. He said that if the situation in the ground war is indeed going well, as Zelensky and the Western media say, if it is indeed the case that the tide in the ground war is turning, then why exactly is Zelensky's government now far more active than it has ever been in building fortifications around Kiev itself, as well as other Ukrainian cities further west, like Volyn and, of course, Odessa? I don't know that he's been provided with any answer to this question, but the answer actually is obvious enough. The situation on the front lines for Ukraine is not improving, it is deteriorating. The Ukrainians do fear, anticipate exactly the kind of scenario that I outlined a moment ago, where maybe the city of Sumy itself has fallen, where the Russians are pressing on Kharkiv, where Donbass has fallen, where the Russians are at the gates of Zaporozhye city and on the Dnieper, and where Russian forces are indeed starting to arrive in big numbers in Belarus, the two reserve armies, and where Russian forces are also building in Sumy region, preparing to advance to Kiev from the east, and where Kiev itself, badly pounded, perhaps by this point without electric power, has been reduced, has been hollowed out, and is as vulnerable to attack as, say, Berlin was in the spring of 1945. But to repeat again, we are not yet there. We're not there yet. The Ukrainians may be anticipating it. By the Ukrainians, I mean Zelensky and his officials. The Russians may be taking the first steps to prepare for it, but we are not there yet. Now, let us turn again to the situation in the Middle East before we round off this program. Firstly, the situation in the Middle East remains as stalemated as it has always been. It is not a stalemate, in fact. It is, as my colleague and friend Alex Christoforou said, a waiting game. The Iranians have staked out their positions. They are not prepared to hand over their enriched uranium stockpile to the Americans. They are not prepared to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz unless their assets are unfrozen and paid back to them. They want the US bases in the Persian Gulf to close. They want the sanctions eventually to be lifted. They want guarantees against a renewal of the war. And they are waiting for the day when the Americans start to talk about and concede on all of these issues, because the situation in the global economy is now deteriorating. So that is the Ukrainian position. Sorry, that is the Iranian position. The American position is that they're still hoping that the sea blockade will put some further pressure on the Iranians, and they try to scare the Ukrainians by occasionally testing the ceasefire, by conducting largely ineffectual, as far as I can see, strikes against some Iranian positions close to the Strait of Hormuz and certain naval targets, but the Americans are always careful to do so in a very limited way. They don't want the entire ceasefire to collapse. They know their Persian Gulf allies would be horrified if it did. They worry about the effect on the global economy and on energy prices if it did, so that these attacks that the Americans conduct should be seen rather as harassment of the Iranians as opposed to real, genuine, concrete military action. So this is the situation that we are in actually in the war. And Pezeshkian, the Iranian president, called together the various business associations and chambers of commerce in Iran, and he told them that this is now, as much as anything else, a war of economic attrition, that it is essential that Iran withstands it, that the business community, the private business community, will have to bear much of the pressure, that the government will do what it can to support them, but ultimately this is a test of endurance that Iran must win because it is not prepared to retreat from its red lines. And well, President Trump, for the moment at least, and his officials remain, as far as I can see, very reluctant to take any radical economic action in the face of what I suspect are going to be the mounting problems that they're going to face in the next few weeks, unless there is indeed a resolution to the war. My strong sense, in fact, I have some information on this, but I don't want to talk about this. But my strong sense is that we got very close about a week ago towards the start of the weekend to getting President Trump to sign off on the MOU. And by the way, on that topic, I've been receiving some information, again from a source, very well-known source. I don't want to disclose him because this is in private emails, though, to be truthful, I feel that there's no special need to withhold the name of this person. I hope he doesn't mind in future if I do. I will ask him. But I've received some legal advice, and not just legal advice, but some, if you want to put it like this, diplomatic advice from this person, who's pointed out that an MOU, even if it is more a declaration of intent than a legal document as such, but an MOU can be quite easily converted into a signed treaty and agreement. And he speculates, I have no doubt correctly, that if Trump did indeed sign off on the MOU, that is indeed, as he says, what the Iranians would try to make it become. And I have no doubt that is correct. And I have no doubt that that is indeed Iran's long-term negotiating strategy. To get Trump to sign this document in the knowledge that even if it is not binding at the moment, the pressure to make it binding will then grow, and then to move forward and to make it actually binding, just to say. Anyway, I think we got very close to that point at the start of the past weekend. But then Prime Minister Netanyahu called President Trump, and we had the carefully orchestrated succession of statements from the neocons, from Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Mike Pompeo, Robert Kagan, all of them, the procession, one after the other. And Donald Trump backed off. And, well, Trump then conducted the further strike. He can authorize this further strike. And I suspect it was intended to rattle and intimidate the Iranians. And, of course, he did no such thing. Well, there it is. I don't think that there is anything that Donald Trump can do or the United States can do that will cause the Iranians to shift their position. I think that the Iranians, with every single passing day, feel that their position is getting stronger and stronger. A very interesting, rather revealing article in the Financial Times today will have strengthened them in that view. And by the way, the Iranians most definitely do read every single article about themselves and pertaining to the situation in the Middle East that appears in the major organs of the Western media, just to say. Anyway, this article says that there are no funds deposited whatsoever in the account of Donald Trump's Board of Peace. The Russians, I remember, looked at depositing funds in it, but they thought better of it. The Persian Gulf states at one time all said they would deposit money in it, but it seems as if they have never followed through. And after the start of the war with Iran on the 28th of February, they've quietly decided not to work, not to act out their commitments. So the Board of Peace, created supposedly to supervise the ceasefire in Gaza, of which one ought to say there is, at the moment at least, a very significant reduction in fighting in Gaza, though not yet anything that, in my opinion, comes close to approximating to an actual complete ceasefire there. But anyway, this Board of Peace essentially now looks like a dead letter. And given how much of President Trump's credibility in the Middle East revolved around it, and given the importance he himself attached to it, I suspect that for him personally, this is a significant blow. And the fact that the money from the Persian Gulf isn't flowing into it will also be a blow at various other levels as well. Bear in mind that President Trump's chairmanship of the Board of Peace, with a vast pile of money that is supposed to be eventually locked into its accounts, is a lifetime appointment. You could almost say a post-presidency retirement plan for Donald Trump. And for that further reason, I think he's going to be very disappointed by the fact that it isn't playing out at all in the way that he expected. Well, there it is. What President Trump does need to remember is that if indeed we do start to see energy prices start to surge over the next few months, specifically in June, as many people, many commentators in the energy industry, experts in the energy industry are saying, then he might find himself obliged to negotiate with the Iranians, but doing so from an even weaker position than the one in which he is in now. If that happens, then skillful negotiators, as the Iranians unquestionably are, it is not impossible that they will increase their demands over and above those which they have made up to now. I have argued in many places, including on X and on Substack, that the Iranian demands, far from being unreasonable, would work in America's, actually in America's best interests, were the Americans to accept them. It would open the way for the United States to disengage itself from the Middle East, and it would also create conditions where the United States could be confident, as a result of the procedures put in place, that Iran indeed would not move forward to develop a nuclear weapon. So, actually, in my opinion, objectively, in Americans' interests, it should agree the deal with Iran. That may not be true if the president delays a further month, and if he is forced eventually into an agreement imposed on the US by the Iranians, which requires the United States to make significant concessions over and above the actually reasonable concessions that the Iranians are currently asking for. Well, then, in that case, he should be under no doubt at all that the neocons and the Israelis and the army of commentators that back him, that back them, will all round on him and will name him as the author of the debacle. Yes, they will do so, even if he makes the concessions and agrees the MOU now. But it will be nothing compared to what it might be in a month or 2 months or 3 months' time. And of course, he can rightly say that the only reason he didn't sign the MOU when it was offered in its present form was because the neocons and the Israelis argued against it. But nobody is going to listen or care. So, in his interests, in the interests of the United States and of the world altogether, I would suggest to the president, were he listening to this program, which of course he isn't, but I would suggest to him that yes, he should listen to those who are advising him and sign the MOU. Anyway, that's the end of my program for today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, where we have a major sale and promotion underway with massive discounts on all sorts of wonderful things. And last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.